Hi, welcome to the Mill of Tech Ready. I'm glad that you guys can all make it and make it across the concourse. I never realized that the North End was so much further than the South End. It's a nice good morning exercise. And I'll have to stand over here because the monitor there, I didn't realize, but it's pretty high. And if I stood here, this is all you see of me, so stand over here. My name is Il-Sung Lee, and I'm a program manager within the what we call the information governance vector within the SQL Server product and SQL Azure. We had a reorg. If you guys work for any sizable company, you guys know that reorgs are a fact of life. And about every, sadly, year or so, we're going to have another reorg. Next year, if you see me, it might be called something else. But nonetheless, for the last few years, I've been doing the same kind of work, which is focusing on security. And today, I want to talk about auditing in SQL Server 2012. And first of all, I'm very impressed that there's a lot of you out here who are interested in audit. How many people here are already using SQL Server Audit? Show of hands, please. So good, almost half of you. How many of you here are here because you need to consider for things like compliance? Okay, so that's most of you. And that's typically what I hear. Customers want to actually learn about auditing. It's not necessarily because I want to do it, which you should, by the way, because if you're a good security citizen, you want to keep track of these things. But there's more and more kind of breach notification laws and mandates from the government that require you to actually be able to prove and show what's happened. What have your privileged administrators, what have they done in the case of a breach, like what was breached, things like this, right? And so these are all really, really strong motivations for you to actually go and start looking into, setting up audit for your database. Okay, so today what I'd like to do is, let me grab the clicker here, is I'm going to go and answer, how many questions is that? Six. So I'm going to go and talk about six questions that people typically ask about auditing in SQL Server. And during the course of these six questions, I'm hoping that you're going to learn something. Actually, I guarantee that you're going to walk away here learning at least something new about audit. And if you've already known all this, then you can probably take my job because, I mean, that's good. But throughout these questions, I'll explain it, then I'll give you a very, very quick demo. It's not going to be anything too elaborate or anything like that. I'll explain to you, show you it in action, and then go back and explain the next thing. So it'll be like, quick, 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 quick. Okay? And if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me and just let me know. Unfortunately, with these lights, I'm having a really hard time seeing everyone, so you may have to kind of call out, and I'll try to get to your question as soon as I can. All right, let's get started. So the first question is, what's changed in SQL Server 2008? So for the veterans here who have already used 2008, you probably want to know what's different now. Why should I use 2012? And I'm going to show you some of the reasons why you want to use 2012 here. Okay. The answer is lots. Okay, we made lots of changes to the SQL Server audit. It's more flexible, more reliable, among other things. And specifically, these are the things that we've actually done to make SQL Server audit better. Okay, so there's auditing support in all SKUs. Okay, no applause. Okay. Improved resilience, user-defined audit events, record filtering, and T-SQL stack information. So when I say audit is supported on SKUs, I should really caveat that, okay? Yes, you can actually go and define audit on, say, Express if you want in SQL Server 2012, okay? But there are some kind of limitations that differentiate between enterprise. Whereas in enterprise, you get to do everything. In the other SKUs, you can set up the server audit specifications, but you can't create the database audit specifications. So again, if you're familiar with the auditing feature already, what this basically means is that it's more equivalent to trace, where when you set up a trace, it basically covers everything, all the databases in your instance. And with SQL Server Audit, you are able to say that I only want this for one particular database, or I want to set up granular activities so that I only collect selects on this table from user Bob. And you need to have a database audit specification for that, and so that'll still be limited to enterprise, but in terms of all the other stuff that happens, in terms of setting up a kind of audit for overall the entire instance, you can do that on all the different SKUs. Now, what this also means is that you can stop using trace. I can now use audit as my kind of central solution for all across the different instances, across enterprise, work group, whatever else. And I get to take advantage of the benefits that audit gives me over trace. And some of the key things are things like performance. Okay, I'll talk about this in a little bit, where you see that the performance is actually appreciably different. You can have multiple audit targets and multiple audits. So one of the key things that I actually like to tell people that they may not be aware is that I don't have to have one audit. I can have multiple audits. They're all independent from each other. They can audit different things. They can be turned on and off independently, and they can send things to different, you know, targets. Okay, and that's completely possible. Your persist state, Trace was really bad about this. You know, if someone pulled the plug or you had a power outage and you came back up, Trace would not be active. You'd have to go and manually restart it, right? But audit persist the state. So we check to see whether it was on the last time we were running, and if it was, next time we start up, we just automatically start it. The first thing we do, very, very early in the actual startup sequence of SQL Server, audit will start up and fire an event. And then audit resilience. Okay, I'm going to talk about this in a little bit, but basically what this does is that it gives us the ability to actually, you know, lose less of our audit records in some situations. And let me discuss that next. So before, I was able to, before, if I had failures to write to the audit log for whatever reason, and a very typical situation is that, you know, I may want to put all my audit logs to a share that's over the network, and that the network has a hiccup or it goes down, and then I start failing to write. Well, what would happen is that, you know, in most cases, you're going to start losing audit records because we're just going to suddenly fail rather than, you know, kind of detrimentally hinder the server from actually, you know, servicing requests. The other thing you could have done is that you could have specified that on failure, I want to shut down the instance, okay? And how many people actually use this? Well, see, no one's put up their hand, and very, very rarely have I ever heard of anyone using this. Usually people who do use this are people who are in very high security kind of areas, or sometimes it's a government where, you know, it's more important for them to have audit records than to have, and have all the activity audited than actually start running without it, okay? But in practice, can you imagine that you have some, you know, your production database and, you know, the network goes down, you can't write to your audit log, and the whole server comes down? You know, it's not very appealing for DBAs and their job security, so they typically don't do this, right? But now what we can do is that we actually have implemented more kind of resiliency so that if we do actually fail to write to the log for whatever reason, then instead of just, like, you know, throwing away the records and just keep on continuing, what we'll do is that we'll actually keep trying over and over until we can eventually write, so we actually, you know, recover from these kind of errors much, much better, okay? And we've added a couple of features, kind of options. So instead of on-failure shutdown, we have one called on-failure fail operation. And so in that little diagram down there, very simple, you know, the client actually does a select against the server, and for whatever reason, I can't write to the audit log again, and then what will happen if I have on-failure fail operation is that it will cause it to actually roll back the transaction, okay? It'll return an error and the transaction roll back. And so the benefit of this is that if I have other activity going against the database that doesn't have anything to do with this particular audit, and meaning that it doesn't generate an event, then that stuff will still continue. It's not affected at all. But anything that's gonna cause it to, you know, try to generate a log, entry into that failed audit will roll back and fail, okay? So it gives you a little bit more flexibility. And then also we've added the max files option. So what this does is that, you know, before I can say that I want 10 logs of, say, 20 megs each. Okay, so 200 megs of logging, which isn't actually that much. And then once you hit the 11th, you're just gonna roll over, right? And so the problem with that is that it helps you contain, you know, say that I'm gonna have exactly this much audit information, but if you don't archive these things fast enough, you know, you may have lost some audit records because you overwrote some. Well, I mean, what the max files does is that I can say now that I want 10 files, 20 megs each, and when I hit that upper limit, if I don't clear out the log files, then SQL Server will keep on, you know, wait until the log file is cleared up. Okay, so it'll basically hold up that transaction. So this is another way of actually not losing audit records, but also making sure that you control the amount of audit records that you generate and keep. Any questions, guys? The question is there a failover location where the audit logs are stored? Did I get it right? So there is no failover location. Your audit logs are actually, you know, where you specify them to be. So you control exactly where they go, and you control, you know, with the high availability of that space. Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is T-SQL stack information. Now, you may be asking, why is this useful? Why is this important? Well, I'll tell you why. I have a client right there, and suppose I do, you know, I invoke a stored proc that actually does, you know, select salary from the payroll table. Okay, very common, right? I'm sure a lot of you guys are doing something like this already, where, you know, the payroll table is your valuable asset, and you're controlling access to it through the stored proc. So typically, I would say I deny you the ability to select from that table, but I give you the ability to execute the stored procedure. And, you know, if you want to get a little more geeky in security terms, what I would probably do is that I would probably, you know, sign it cryptographically with a certificate so that people can change it. Okay, you can do that in SQL Server. But that's beside the point. Very common way of actually, you know, controlling the logic and access to your data, right? The problem is that if I want to set up an audit against the HR payroll table, okay, that says that, you know, I want to know when anyone does a select in this table, I can't tell whether it came directly from the customer, I mean from the client, which is bad, or if it came from the stored procedure, which is okay, right? And so what we do now is that, you know, when you actually go and audit this, in the additional info column, which already exists, we're going to put the parent's T-SQL stack frame information in there, so you'll be able to tell exactly where it came from. And let me show you. And there we go, demo. Okay, this thing was acting flaky earlier, so pray to the demo gods. Oh, that was good this year. All right, guys, so can you guys see everything? Okay. If you guys can't see, I'll try to increase the font size or use Zoomit or something like that, so that's not a problem for me. So I've created the HR database, and I'm just going to create a couple accounts. You know, I'm going to create one called app account. You know, this is going to be represent my one kind of user that connects on behalf of the application. Okay, and then I don't actually know why I put this here. I think I just put it there in case I needed him, but I'm going to create a user called Bob as well. And, you know, let's go ahead and create the scenario that I just kind of showed you on my slide deck. So as good developers, we always create a separate schema, right? No DBO schemas. Okay, I know you guys all knew this. So yeah, we create an HR schema because we don't want it to have the same kind of schema space. I'm going to create a table. I'm going to put a couple of dummy, you know, values in there. And, you know, it's very, very simple. Then I'm going to create the stored procedure. And the stored procedure, you know, I'm not a fancy T-SQL developer, but, you know, all I do is I take in the integer of the employee ID and I dump out the salary for that guy. Okay, I'd probably have better logic than that in a real production system, but that's okay. And again, typically what I'll do is I'll deny anyone from selecting from that table because I don't want them direct access, but I will let them execute from it. Okay? So let's take a look at something, right? If I do like a select from HR payroll, right, and let me do this actually. Yeah, if I do a select from HR payroll, then I get the values back. And right now I'm logged in as the DBO, so I can do everything, even with the denies and everything else. But, you know, if I do something like, you know, SQL CMD minus S minus U, what was that, app account minus P, my password. I think that's it. Oh, there we go. So now if I go use HRDB, App account is not able to access under the current security. Oh, you're right. You're right. You guys are so good. Okay. And there, HRDB. Let me go through this really quickly. Okay. Sorry about that. Da-da. Oops. Okay, just a small delay here. I'm going to deny, and then I'm going to go and grant. And again, now if I do a select, I should be fine, right? Okay, so that's fine. Before I do that, though, let me set up the audit as well. And if you guys haven't tried audit yet, it's super simple, right? So all I have to do now is I just have to go to security and say that I want to right-click on audit, new audit, and I can give it whatever name I want. Let's say audit demo. Okay. If you look here, you'll see a couple of things, right? And let me get zoom it in here so you guys can see it. Whoops. Okay. So if you look here, you'll see that there's a couple things. There's a continue thing I was talking about earlier. That's what the default is. And then the shutdown server is the next option, then fail operation. Okay, these are all the things I was just talking about. In terms of file, I'll just make it, it's C-audit. You know, you probably can put wherever you want. And then I'll leave everything else the same. I don't really care. And with that, I've created that audit object. Now what I need to do is that I need to go and create an audit on that database itself, right? So if I refresh that, oops, this is not working well. Okay, if I go to here, refresh, okay, go to HRDB, and then over here I have security, and there is the database audit specifications. So this is where I specify, you know, what I want to audit in that database. And so now I just say new database. I can give it whatever I want, audit, demo, spec, call it whatever. You have to associate it with the audit object that you created, right? So there I created with audit demo. And then what I'm going to do is that I am going to want to monitor any select, right, on an object. And this object will be the HR payroll table. Okay. And I want to audit anytime anyone touches that table. Okay, so the way that I represent that is that I say that I want to audit for public. And okay, and that's it, right? That's all you have to do. Now the thing is that you have to enable these things. Okay, so they are by default start disabled. So what I would do is I would say enable, that's done, and then enable, that's done. Okay. And so now what we'll see is that if we go here, dock this back, dock. Anyway, so what you'll see is that if I go here, and how do I dock this over here? No, anyways, it doesn't matter. And just right-click on the audit, you'll see what happens. Now, in this case here, dock is tabbed open. Hold on. This is annoying. Okay, so what I'll do here is, if I go to the select from start HR payroll, and I issue that, right, then what will happen, ooh, I'm debugging the query now. Okay, so if I go back, I apologize about this, and go and select start from HR payroll, then we get this. Now all I have to do is look at the audit log, and you will see that if I just say view audit logs, you'll see that in here I get one entry written that says that I did a select from that audit from that table, right? And furthermore, I mean, it gives you all sorts of information. It'll tell you about who the principal is and things like that. So right here, I connected as myself. I'm Redmond Ilsung, and you know, it'll also tell you things like, you know, if I didn't, what statements I issued, over here it's, you know, select from payroll. Now, on the converse, let me show you what would happen if I connect and I go in and try to select from the store proc. So I've connected here, and let's go use HRDB. And if I do a select star from HR payroll, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to fail, right? Because I don't have permission on that. But if I do exec, you know, HR view salary, and I think 2, 4, 5, 6, I think that was one. Try that. And so I get the results back. Now let's see how this reflects in the audit log itself. So if I go and look at the audit log again, you're going to see that there are now three selects audited, right? The first one was the one I did as sysadmin, and you know, that's the one that actually went through. The key things I want to kind of point out here is that, first of all, the second one where I tried to do a select, it turned out it succeeded false. Even though I didn't manage to select any data, we still audit everything, right? And I tell you that, you know, you failed to do this. You tried, but you failed. And then the second, the most recent one there, the select on the table, shows I succeeded because we were able to select from the table. Now, let's see what the difference is. So in this case right here, you will see that, first of all, you know, we actually, like, log, the statement that was issued against that table, right? And when we actually look at the T-SQL stack information, you see that, you know, for the most recent one, we do show the frame level, and this was actually called from an object named HRViewSalary. Okay? So very, very easy way for you to tell where the query came from, whether it's a okay or if it was a bad thing that someone did. Okay? Any questions? All right. Back to the slides. So the question was, why don't we audit more of the stack on the ones that fail? It's a way that the audit's actually implemented, because the way that audit actually works is that it's kind of hand-in-hand with our permission checks. So when you actually go and try to do something, we do a permission check, and at that point, we generate the audit. Okay? And then when we actually see that you can't access this object, we fail right away. Okay? And we just at that point, we just say that, you know, you failed to try to do this, and that's it. But that's basically the technical issue. In terms of you know, whether we should do this or not, it's something that we could consider. And if you're really interested in this, please come and talk to me afterwards, and I'd like to understand more about, you know, your situation. Okay. The next thing that I want to talk about is the user-defined audit event. Okay. This is the ability for someone to say that, hey, I want to write something into the audit log, okay, and say that, you know, the audit log's fine, but I want to actually put some kind of, you know, personal messages or markers in there. And we actually allow you to do this now. We provide you with a store proc or a spec proc called SP Auto Write. And there's only three parameters to it. You know, it's very simple. All you have to do is, I'm pinging the wrong button. The first one there is, you know, the user-defined event ID. So it's just whatever you want to actually put in there that defines that, hey, this is the way I'm going to keep track of all these different events, because, you know, this shows up as one type of audit event in the audit log. The second thing is whether you succeeded or not. Okay, you can mark in that field that I showed you earlier that, hey, this worked, this didn't work. I'm, you know, auditing a failure case, for example. And the next thing is, it's just arbitrary text string. It's not interpreted or anything like that. Whatever you put there, we're just going to dump inside the audit log. Okay, you can put a lot of things in there. Now, why is this kind of useful? Well, I mean, it's useful because I may have a situation like I'm in a three-tier system. I have a web server. The web server connects to SQL Server using the same account all the time. Well, guess what? In the audit log, what's it going to show up as? Well, it's going to show that you, as a web server, did all this activity without, you know, any kind of idea of, you know, who the actual user is. So you could use this to actually, you know, connect and then do a write and say that, hey, I'm actually Bob. Okay, even though in the audit log, I show up as the app account. Okay? So there's a lot of different things you can do with this. But the couple things I want to point out is that this doesn't necessarily mean that you have the ability to just write, you know, that you have the ability to just do this anywhere. There's two things that you have to be able to do before. First of all, you have to give people the permission to call this SP audit write. Okay? If they don't have it, they can't call this anyways. The second thing is that the audit has to be configured to actually listen for this. Okay, so if they're not listening for this, then we're not, no matter how many times they call this, we're not going to pick it up. Okay, so it's very, very configurable from that perspective. And as you can see there, you'll see something like that. And let me show you a quick demo of, you know, what this looks like and how it works. All right. So again, the first thing that we're going to have to do is that we want to be able to, you know, capture those audits. So in order to do that, I need to go and modify this. So I'm going to disable the audit spec so I can modify it. And then I'm going to go to properties, and I'm going to add something called user-defined audit group. Okay? And then I'm going to re-enable it. So now, if I go to, say, you know, right here, and, you know, I've already granted, well, actually, I haven't. So I'm going to go use master, I'm going to grant execute on the SP audit write to the app account. Okay, so they can actually call it now. And then I'm going back to the HRDB. I'm going to cheat a little bit. Instead of logging in through a command line, I'm just going to execute as. If you guys don't know about this, it's a quick way of actually, you know, like boarding, log in, log out. Very, very handy for especially demos. And all I'm going to do is that, you know, in the situation where I connect it as my app account and I want to actually just mark in the audit log and say that, hey, you know what, I'm that, the application user is actually this during this period for this session. And then that's all I have to do, okay? And, you know, I can do something like, you know call the store proc again. And now let's take a look at the audit log and see what it generates. So we take a look at this, view auto log settings, and you will see here, and I'll zoom in, so just bear with me for a second, that we have the user-defined audit event listed there, okay? And furthermore, if you kind of scroll all the way to the end here, there is the information that you entered into your thing, right? So right now, you can see that for that event, we have the user-defined ID and the text I put in there. So very handy, okay? You can do this for whatever you want. I think the only limitation is that user-defined information field, I think it's around 4K or something like that. Okay, so you can put up to that much information in there. Most people don't need that much information, but you can, okay? And, you know, obviously if you start using this a lot, you know, you may end up kind of making things a little bit unreadable, but it's completely your choice. All right? Okay. I told you they're quick demos. I do one longer demo at the end, so these ones are just to kind of quickly demonstrate these things. So the next thing I want to talk about is record filtering, okay? Very, very useful feature. And the reason is this. I can now set up a filter in my audit that filters out exactly gets written into the audit log based on any field in the audit log, in the audit record, okay? So what I can basically do now is that I can say that I only want to audit things that come from this user, you know, even at the server level, or I only want to audit things that have, like a blank T-SQL stack information, or whatever you want, okay? Basically, what we're doing is that we're exposing the X-Event filtering functionality because audit's built on top of X-Events. That's how we get a lot of our performance. Okay, it's a special X-Event session, but still X-Events nonetheless. And X-Events provides a very, very nice kind of, you know, very, very basic filtering where you can define this predicate expression using Boolean expressions, and you can do it on any column in the audit record itself. So basically what it does, like I said before, is that, you know, when we actually go through and we generate the audit record, we'll go through the filter, and if it's not necessary, it doesn't pass a filter, we won't write it. Very, very good way of actually kind of constraining your logs, okay, to exactly what you want, because often what I hear a lot from customers is that, hey, you guys, we generate a lot of information, and, you know, it's actually being a problem because we're generating maybe gigabytes, sometimes terabytes of data. Well, this will allow you to actually carefully fine-tune exactly what you want to audit. Another good application for this is that, you know, for example, I may have a web server that connects to my SQL Server backend, and the web server is doing all the auditing at their level. Okay, they audit everything there, and so we don't need to duplicate this. Okay, but what I do care at the SQL Server level in this case is all the people connect and do things outside of that web server, so they use their own account to connect into it, right? And so I want to capture that audit. Okay, and so let me show you how this would work real quick. So what I'm going to do here is go back here first. Now, the way that I'm going to do this is I'm going to set up a filter in the audit log, and I'm going to show you a way to do it. You can do it through the T-SQL, obviously, but I find it a little bit nicer to show you through the UI. So I'm going to use master, and I'm just going to go on the principal ID, right? So that's why I do this, select S user ID. So it's 265. So what I would do is that I would go to the audit, and let me disable this first. Okay. And let me go and edit it. So here there's a tab called filter, and you can set up your expression there. And so in my case right there, I want server principal ID not equal to 265, because 265 is my app account. And I want to audit everything except things that happen from that app account. Okay? Make sense? Mind you, the other thing I want to just kind of point out is that if I want to have different filters, you know, you can put them all here, or you can create a whole separate audit event, audit object, right? Because like I said before, you can create as many audits as you want. So now that I've done this, all I have to do is say enable. Okay. And if I go back to doing the select, let's see, first of all, select, just to make sure I know who I am at this point. Current user, I'm DBO, so I'm currently logged in as sysadmin pretty much. So if I do a select, I'm going to get all this data back, right? But if I do something from the app account, which I did here, and if I go and issue the same query, which we know is going to generate the audit events, right? and I say go, then I still get this back. And now let's take a look at the audit log and see what the audit log says. And if we take a look, you will see that, let me close this, refresh. Oh, let's do that again. Audit log, demo. Oh, you know why? Because I have to go and enable this over here. 265, principal properties, server principal ID doesn't equal 265. Did I got it right? Yeah. Okay. Let's go restart this. Enable. Okay. And then if I go as, you know, myself, and let's say that I go revert, and I do a select from HR payroll, and hopefully this will work this time. Oh, I didn't get this to work. Sorry? Oh, my master? Man, thank you for pointing this out. I keep on forgetting that all the time. This is why I work in the engineering side and not the development side. Okay, let's do this again. So if we go to select star from HR payroll, okay, this shows up. And again, if I do it through here, I think we've already seen that this doesn't do anything, but I'll do it again. And if I go to the demo, auto demo, and do the view logs, you'll see that the select shows up, but the select there is only capturing the one I did as a DBO, as you can see right there. See? It says I did as a DBO. So the one that actually happened as the app account doesn't show up here. And I can do anything else as app account, it's not going to show up. And, you know, this is assuming that, you know, I have a carefully architected system where I control the app server, I control what happens through there, I log everything through there, so I'm fairly confident that the only thing I need to keep track of at the database level is anything that someone does other than as the app server. Okay. So, again, this is, you know, a very, very useful application of, you know, some of these features that we're providing. Now, let's go back to the PowerPoint, and I'll just wrap up some of the other things that we've done. So what is the performance impact is another question that we get a lot, right, about, you know, how SQL Server Auto works. And the answer is it depends, right? And it depends on a lot of things. It depends on your workload. Okay, it depends on, you know, if you have a lot of things going on, you're going to generate more audit, you know, generate more audit activity, right? It's kind of natural. It depends on what's being audited. Now, if I carefully target my audits to exactly the few things I need, that's going to be a lot more performant than, you know, auditing everything that happens in the system. And what we did is that we took, just as a benchmark, we did a comparison between SQL Server Audit and SQL Server Trace to see what the performance difference would be. And here I just kind of listed out some of the workloads. These are actually, you know, typical customer workloads that we've, you know, got from some customers. And, you know, they have various kind of, you know, database sizes, and, you know, number of tables, number of statements executed. There's a lot more information. This is also in the audit white paper if you want more details. And this is sort of the kind of numbers that we've seen. So the key thing I want to point out here is that in all cases, SQL Server Audit is faster than SQL Server Trace. Okay, a lot of that is because SQL Server Audit has a much, much more performant, I/O infrastructure, namely the extended events. And in some cases, it's 44% faster, you know, at least 11%, 44% faster. And you can see that in workload 2, there's a dramatic difference between the purple, which is a trace, and the red, which is audit. Okay? And the reason for this is that typically, you know, audit will excel much, much more than trace, particularly when there's large amounts of file I/O. So in that one, I can presume that there's a lot of audit information generated. And because of this, you know, the trace had a harder time keeping these huge volume of audits, you know, flushed out to disk. Now, in this situation, though, what we did is this is a worst-case scenario. Okay, the worst-case scenario is where we turn on everything. Okay, you know, I mean, it's a little bit suicidal, but, you know, it's definitely not that bad in some cases because you can see the audit doesn't impact the non-audit case that much, which is in blue. And we did this to kind of emphasize the point. Now, The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, if you were to actually use audit and kind of scope things down to particular databases or only certain people or certain you know, tables, you could kind of scope really down that you couldn't do in trace, and you get even bigger differences. Okay, so I guess my kind of point for the slide is use audit, don't use trace. Okay. Any questions? This is a question I get asked all the time. Okay, and can I protect the audit logs from the DBA? Because a lot of times people are trying to kind of keep tracks on their DBAs. Not that DBAs are bad people, but you know, you may have regulatory compliance needs to say that I need to keep track of all administrative activity, right? I mean, you guys have probably all heard that. And the answer is yes, right? I've actually really, really been tempted to go to one of these sessions and just put no there and see how people react, but people told me it wouldn't be a good idea. So yes, you can. Okay, and the way that I kind of outlined the strategy for this, and I've told this to multiple people, is that, first of all, we can log to the Windows Security Log. And if you know that the Windows Security Log is so-called tamper-proof log that Windows provides, you know, they provide, you know, hashing and everything else so that, you know, you can't tamper with it. If you delete it for whatever reason, it gets recorded, all that kind of stuff. And second of all, I mean, assuming that your DBA isn't the Windows administrator, which you should try not to do anyways, right? Because you want this clear separation. If you're a smaller company, you may not have a choice, but, you know, especially if you're facing regulatory compliance, you're going to find increasingly more and more that they're demanding that the Windows and SQL administrators are separate. And if you do put this to a security log, you can take advantage of things like the System Center Operation Manager Audit Collection Service, and use this as a way of collecting audits from different machines and generating reports off of them. The one thing that I kind of highlight about this is that it's very secure, it's very, very secure, but at the same time, it's not terribly performant compared to files, okay? So it's not bad, but if you're really, really, you know, doing a lot of high volume and you really, really care about performance, because who doesn't, then the security log is going to slow you down a bit. The other thing you can do is that you can copy the audit logs to a secure location. Files are much faster, and I've been asked this several times in the booths, and the way I explained it to them is that the reason files are faster is because we don't do any post-processing. We take the thing that's in memory and dump it to file. That's why we get this binary format, okay? Which is also the reason that it's not compressed or anything. But anyway, so we copy. If you copy the logs to a different location, then the thing to keep in mind is that the logs, as they're being written by SQL Server, is held by a lock. So SQL Server provides, exclusive write, shared read lock on that file itself. Okay. So while SQL Server has that audit log locked, no one else can really tamper with it because it's locked by that process. And you can copy the contents off of this thing. Okay. There's only a small kind of possible exposure, which is when if you configure multiple audit logs and you kind of, you know, fill up one log and you go to the other audit log, during that process by which it releases a lock here and moves a lock here, you know, you can have like, you know, milliseconds of vulnerability if someone can get in there and, you know, do something with that log in that time before you copy it off the machine. But highly, highly unlikely, right? And then you move these logs to a share that the DBA or the, you know, people you're trying to protect against do not have access to. Okay. And so this is a way that you can actually do this. Or you can do a combination of the two. And I like this solution because it kind of leverages some of the key benefits of audit, which is that I can have multiple audits. So for the low volume, high sensitivity stuff that I'm keeping track of my administrator, because your administrator shouldn't be doing a whole lot. They create tables, users, things like that once in a while. I'll just send all that stuff to the security log. And then for all the high volume stuff, like, you know, access to the tables, logins, logouts, I'll send that to a file. Okay. And this is a very, very good solution to actually, you know, keeping your audit log safe. Any questions around that? Good. Next point I have is what happens when the audit fails to write? I kind of touched about this earlier. It's a very, very, you know, important question because if you have to make sure that I audit all my activity and I don't want, you know, these things to actually not get recorded somewhere, then I need to know what happens and wonder in what situations I may lose audit records. So the answer is it depends, again, okay? And it depends because it depends on how you configured your audit. So, for example, when I said audit write failure and shut down, okay, that was that option I talked about earlier, which is that thing right there, then what happens is that, you know, the server's going to shut down and we're going to, you know, anything that was buffered in the audit, you know, audit queue, like we buffer all the audit events, is going to get lost. And to kind of give you you know, more of an explanation around what happens in some other cases, like in the common case where we actually continue, where we, you know, we say that, you know, I'm going to let the server continue. If I can't audit, then, you know, just please keep on going on. And I understand that I may lose some audit events. And the way that this works is that, you know, we buffer these audit events. So each audit session has around a 4-meg buffer that's predefined. You can't configure, in case you're going to ask. And this roughly translates to at least 170 entries, probably a lot more than that, because 170 is assuming that you've taken the maximum row space. Okay, so at least 170 entries may be there, depending on the size of the statement text. And if the buffer gets filled, then what happens is that the server blocks new activities that generate the audit events, okay, and you know, it does not affect any of the other audits. You know, these are all independent. And we keep on buffering until the buffer space is free, or it blocks, I'm sorry, until the buffer space is freed, or we disable the audit. So you can go in there and you can say, I'm going to turn off the audit. Of course, if you turn off the audit, you're just losing everything that you've kind of buffered so far. And then finally, we just keep on doing this until we get a system error back. Like, for example, Windows tells us that, you know, the file is inaccessible. And at that point, what we do is, under the covers, we'll shut off the audit session. Okay, so the audit will turn off, any of the buffered events will be lost, and you know, we will not use that audit session anymore until you manually go there and try to turn it back on. Okay. The other kind of things is that we, you know, we enhanced this in SQL Server 2012, so we continue trying to write to the audit log. Okay, and we'll automatically try to restart if the audit event is generated. Now, in the new part in SQL Server 2012, where we actually allow you to say fail operation, that thing I told you about where these guys are going to fail, but everything else that doesn't touch the audit log continues, the audit events are buffered again. This is exactly the same. Okay, so we'll keep on buffering until we fill up. And then once a buffer is filled up, the server fails any new activity that generates an audit event that goes to that log. Okay, so again, it doesn't affect any other audits. The failed, you know, fails new operations until the buffer space is freed or disabled, and we continuously try to rewrite until we actually, you know, you shut down the audit or the server shuts down or something like that. So we'll perpetually keep the events in that audit buffer until we're able to write again. So, for example, if, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I put ACLs on that file, I can't write to the audit log, I'd say, wow, I was stupid. Let me go and remove those ACLs, then we'll just automatically, just seamlessly, just keep going. We'll continue. Any questions around that? Okay. Now, the situation may come up, and I've actually heard of a few people who have hit this condition, that what I do if the server fails to start because of SQL Server audit? I said that I want to shut down on failure, but now that I shut down on failure, I can't restart it because I can't write to the audit log. Because remember, when you first start SQL Server, and if you have an audit enabled, one of the first things I do right early in the process is I start up audit, and I write in the audit log that we turned on audit. Okay, and now, if I can't write to that log, then I'm going to shut down the server. You guys kind of see the problem, right? So one thing you can do is you can start the server in single user mode, and this will work. And let me explain to you. So first of all, your first option should be that you should correct the source of the error. Right, so the file system's full. Okay. The second thing you should do is that you should try to start it in single user mode if you, for whatever reason, you can't correct the error. And what this does is that the audit still is active, but we turn off the logic to shut down the server on failure. Now, this is just so you can get in there, fix this, change your audit, maybe set to a new target, and then, you know, modify or turn off whatever, and then get back out, because obviously you don't want to run your server in single user mode. And the third option would be, you know, in the worst case, you start the server in minimal configuration mode, -F, okay? And this is something that you don't normally want to do because it shuts off all the audits, okay? So this is kind of a drastic measure where you get in there, you know, your server's not very usable at this point anyways, but you can get in there, you can go and configure the audit, and then, you know, you can go in and get out and restart your server normally. And then another situation that's kind of separate from this, besides these three, is that if I already have audit enabled, and instead of shut down server, I use fail operation, and I am auditing the audit change group. So I can specifically say that I want to audit anytime anyone does any changes to any audit in the system. But if it fails, I want to fail the operation. You can get yourself in this weird cycle, just like we have with the shutdown server. And for this, what you can do is you can do any of the things I mentioned above, or you can actually go and connect to the DAC. Okay? And the DAC will allow you to go and kind of bypass the fail operation. Any questions around that? All right. So I usually like to finish off with this demo. Now, I've done this demo before, but I think it's actually a pretty cool demo. So it kind of ties a lot of things up together around, you know, like how to use audit and then use PBM for my compliance needs and things like that, okay? So let me kind of set the stage. How many people here have used policy-based management? A few people. So you guys are probably much better than I am because I'm not terribly good at it. But I do know how to use it for this demo, and I do know how to use it for this purpose. Okay, so what I'll do is I want to create a condition for my audit that says something like, you know, I want to know when audits are enabled in my system. Okay, my company policy says that I must have audit enabled everywhere, and I want to check real quickly. And so how do I do that? Well, you can use PBM. You can use a lot of different things, but PBM is one way to do it, definitely. So the way you do this is that I specify a new condition, and I can say, you know, audit on condition, whatever you want to call it. And you can say that for the audit facet, I just want to know if it is enabled. Here we go. And the value is true. Okay? That's all it is. So now if I go and say OK, and then I create a policy based on that condition, then I can say audit on policy. The check condition is the one that I just created right now. And I'm going to have it on demand. You can have the schedule to run it periodically. If you set up a server group within PBM, you can actually use it to actually go monitor multiple servers. But for the purpose of this demo, I'm just doing it against my local instance. And now that I've done that, I'm just going to do it on demand. So I'm going to say evaluate. Okay, and it tells you that right there, evaluate for every audit on demand, server restriction, no, close. Okay, so evaluate. And so you see here that it gives you a green for this target here. And this target is my audit demo audit, right? And this is kind of show you that it's actually working. Let me go and do something else as well. Let me go and create a separate audit. You know, so let me say it is, let's see, audit test. Okay, and put that in C audit. And I'm going to go into a different database this time, let's say TestDB, and create a quick audit there, which I'm not going to enable or anything like that. So new audit specification, you know, let's say that audit test, and you know, database object change group, okay? So I do that, and now if I go back and reevaluate the policy, you know, sure enough, it does what you expected, that there's two things listed, one red, one green, and you can see that the audit demo is green, but the audit test is red, okay? Very, very simple way to actually say that, hey, all my audits are running, and they're running as they should. Now, the problem with this is that, you know, there's some, it's fairly limited in this case because if I'm a really, really kind of, you know, paranoid DBA or security conscious DBA is a better word, then it's not just good enough for me to know that the audits are enabled. I also want to know that the audits are configured the way I want, right? Because, you know, they may have turned on the audit, but they may not be auditing anything. So there's a way to actually get around this limitation in PBM. Because PBM allows you to actually go and, you know, evaluate arbitrary T-SQL expressions. So let me show you how to do that. So first of all, what I'll do is that I will create a new condition. Okay, let's call this condition good audit condition. And I'm going to evaluate this against every database. Okay, so I'm going to set the facet to database, which means that that's the scope. And over here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and scroll down to, what is it, execute SQL. There we go. And this allows me to evaluate an arbitrary SQL expression, right? And here I will return a numeric type. And you'll see why in a second. And here I'm going to enter my expression. Now, as a shortcut, I've already actually kind of spelled out this thing. It's all in the white paper that I wrote a little while ago as well. And essentially what this query does is that it queries each of the databases and tells you whether, you know, they are enabled, first of all, and whether they have the database object change group specified in their database specification. Okay? So what I need to do is that I need to evaluate this, and you know, I have a select one there, because if it's true, then I want to return one. And that's why it says numeric. Makes sense, right? So I'm going to go back here, and I'm going to paste that in there. And I always get trouble with this, but I have to escape the quotes, right? And okay. And I want to evaluate this to one. Right. So there we go. I create that condition. And the next thing I want to do is I want to create a new policy. You can use the same one, but I'm going to create a new policy. And the new policy I'm going to call good audit, you know, policy. And the check condition is that good audit condition I just created, right? And on every database, on demand, it's all good. Let's say OK. Now, if I go through and I go and evaluate this thing now, what do we expect to see? We expect to see, first of all, it's going to ask you to, it gives you this warning first. I just want to tell you it's not an error. Gives you this warning because we're evaluating arbitrary T-SQL. So before they allow you to do this, they ask you, are you really sure you want to do this? I'm really sure. So I'm going to hit evaluate. It gives you another warning, but I say run. And you see that there's two red boxes, right? And why are they red? Well, because you guys sat with me through this whole demo, you know exactly why. Because in the HRDB, the audit that I specified there didn't have the database object change group, right? I mean, I didn't have that. I had some other selects, and I had other things in there, user-defined audit actions. The second one, I do have it, but it's not running. So if I did this demo correctly, then if I go and enable that audit, so I enable this audit here and enable the audit object down there. Where did it go? In the HRDB, right? So I enable this there. So now I have that audit running, and it's monitoring the database object change group. Let's go back and reevaluate this policy. So if I do this and evaluate, it gives me this warning again. I say run, and voila. You see that it tells me right away that, hey, the TestDB has a proper audit enabled, okay, according to my query, which is that it's running and that it has a database object change group there. The first one, even though it's running, it doesn't have the database object change group, and so now I can quickly tell which people have configured their audits the way I want and which ones have not. Okay? A very, very easy way to use, you know, PBM and audit and everything else to kind of meet some of your compliance needs, because I'm sure this is something that you guys can find useful. Any questions around that? All right, guys. We're in the home stretch. Okay. So now that we know that, you know, you can use audit with PBM and make it very, very useful and helps you do a lot of really, really cool stuff, right? Let's ask, is there anything else that you should know? And just a few things, you know. These are things that I try to tell people as fair disclosure so that they know what they're using and what the limitations are. So parameterized queries, if you guys are already using audit, you know that if you use a parameterized query, the audit does not actually provide you with the values of those parameterized queries, the parameters. Okay, they'll put the parameters markers in there. If it's auto-parameterized, then we will actually show the values, but if it's explicitly parameterized, then you won't see it. It's something that, you know, we're aware of. The audit event sessions, like I said, they're actually X event sessions, but you can't use X events to modify them. There's a special X event session that doesn't allow you to actually go and tinker with them. And I explained this earlier, it's a good question, but audit events are fired with permission checks. Writing to files are much faster than vet log, and there's no auditing result sets yet. So we can tell you what the query you issued is, but not what data came back. And then in terms of this modifying the audit. The audit specifications and the audit object itself both have state parameters. This is why you have to turn them on and turn them off. Okay. And you can only change these states outside of a transaction. It's probably not much of an issue because I don't know a lot of people who actually put these things in transactions. And any other audit changes to these audit objects or audit specifications can be done, but you need to turn it off first. You can do it through SSMS, and SSMS under the covers turns it off, changes it, turns it back on for you. But I was just a little bit more explicit because I just want to demonstrate. And especially if you do this with T-SQL, you're going to notice that you're not going to make changes unless you turn the state off first. So kind of in summary, I'd like you to actually consider, you know, using SQL Server Audit for and all the advantages that SQL Server 2012 brings you. I think some of the things that we provide in 2012 are really beneficial and cool, like, you know, some of the filtering stuff and the user-defined audits and stuff that I think that you will find very, very useful for your security and compliance needs. And when you actually start using audits, not just, you know, just blindly just turn everything on, you want to carefully devise a strategy around what needs to be audited and where it needs to go. You know, and it's all kind of contingent upon your security requirements and your performance requirements. You know, security and performance are usually at odds and ends with each other, and it's kind of a trade-off. You know, you can be ultra secure, but your performance is going to be crap, or you can be very, very performant, but then you're not auditing enough. Okay, so you have to carefully think of these things. You know, and generally you want to kind of audit what's enough, but you know, you want to try to limit the scope. You don't want to audit everything that you're not going to use, but not missing the you know, important things. And then, you know, you think about strategies like I gave you earlier. Use files with high volume, you know, audit events. For low volume, very important activities like administrative activities, you can put it to a security log. Okay, it's not going to affect your performance any appreciable amount. And, you know, monitoring the administrator through audit is very possible and it's something that you should consider. Okay, I mean, you know, even if you do trust your DBAs, you probably do have some kind of, you know, policy or company or compliance policies that require you to keep track of all the administrative activities against your server. And there's a few last things. There's a few resources that are available. Okay, there's books online that gives you some of the new features and security enhancements. There's a white paper I wrote for 2008, which is still applicable because the features we introduced in 2012 are just additive. Okay, they don't change any of the features, previous functionality. And there's a security forum that gets monitored very regularly by some people from our team and the MVPs. And, of course, we have a security blog. So with that, there's related content. I noticed that there's a workshop on bare metal Microsoft SQL Server 2012 deployment management, which touched upon some security management issues. And then there's a hands-on lab called Organizational Security and Compliance. So if you are curious about security, I highly recommend actually checking that hands-on lab. And I will be at the booth area for a little while after lunch. So if you want to come see me, then you can. If you can't find me, then here's my information. Okay. I'm not a tweeter, so I don't have a Twitter account for you guys to follow. But you know, feel free to shoot me an email. Just tell me that you know you guys came and saw me at Tech Ed and want to ask me some questions, I'd be very happy to answer. And with that, the rest here are all the advertisements and stuff like that, so I will not get too much into this, but that's it. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, please come by and I'll gladly stick around for a little bit longer. Oh. And also, please complete your evaluations if you don't mind. It's really useful for me as well to just know what I've done well and what I've done poorly or need to improve upon. Thank you.